Huh?
What's that? Yes. But not for a few weeks. We already talked about that. We didn't kids' church.
Spiritual Emphasis Week starts on November 14th. My wife's reminding me. I've been talking to you guys about it. Yeah. Starts in a few weeks. I'll just have to remind you guys as we go. I always think I talk about things, and then people always say that they never hear me, so we'll just put it at that. But anyways, hey, are we going to dismiss Kids for Children's Church, or are they staying in? It's just, you guys staying? Are they going? Okay. Cool. Well, then we'll just get going here. I'm actually doing this for David Banalis, because we were having conversations about love, and he has to do a teaching on love to get a grade for it, so I'm not going to get a grade for it. But it actually fits within the context of what I was talking about the last few weeks. Now, most of you were here last week, but you might want to get that message. It should be up on the website. We had a problem last week in that we didn't have power for about half of the service. So it's the audio quality is definitely lower, but Trent was able to capture it on the videotape. So that's up. But it was a very... I don't think I do a good job most of the time. Last week, I think I did a very good job. So that's just my own arrogance and my own. But that really gave context to some things that I wanted to talk about. So it would help if you understood why I was thinking what I was thinking and why this particular idea of repairs of the world fits with the concept of love, because this is where I'm really, really at. In John chapter 13, verse 34 and 35. As you've noticed, I've been quoting quite a bit from the book of John. It has always been with me. It was the first book that I ever read, and it has always stayed with me as being the lens by which I view the world. Because I read this not as a Christian trying to grow, but I read this as a skeptic who was trying to understand. And so it set the context for how I see Jesus and how I see Jesus relating to the Father and to the Spirit. I see it very descriptive and very clear in the book of John. In John chapter 13, it's a very interesting passage. And yet there are things about John chapter 13 that seem to conflict with each other. And they're so... the stories are so powerful that one tends to just look at the stories in isolation and not look at it in the context of the whole of what's taking place. The scene for John chapter 13, and I'm going to be in verses 34 through 35, the scene for John chapter 13 is a very close, intimate setting. Jesus is, for the last time, having a meeting with his closest friends. I say it that way because they're not just workers at this point in time. Jesus has already told them that you're my friends. And because you're my friends, you know things about me. You know things about God. You know things about each other. All because we're in this interdependent relationship with one another. And this is the scene of Jesus' Last Supper. And Jesus begins this with an incredible act of humility. He washes the feet of the disciples. And I don't know if you've ever had your feet washed. I have had the opportunity to have my feet washed one time that I could think of. And to be honest with you, it was a bit disturbing. It was painful. It was done out of love. But I did not expect the kind of dynamic that took place when one humbles themselves to wash another's feet. It's a very different experience. You would think that you would feel served like one does when they go and, you know, have another kind of an act done, or loving act. So you think that you're going to be somewhat, you know, served, that you feel that way, and thank you for doing that. It's as though someone gave you a gift, but it's something that's very deep, something that's very emotive, something that I'm not sure how I would receive again. It's that powerful of an experience. Now, that may not be the experience for all of you, but it really was an experience for me. It was the most humbling thing that I have ever gone through. Not the washing of one's feet, but to have my feet washed, it was humbling to me. Because I began to see what Peter saw in this encounter with Jesus. Peter is immediately repulsed by the whole idea that Jesus is washing his feet, and I get the point. Because it's painful to see somebody that you so deeply respect, somebody that you would give your life to serve at your feet. Just the whole analogy is disturbing, and that is what has taken place here. Jesus is, in an act of humility, placing himself as the servant of those who have committed themselves to serving Jesus. The second scene in here is even more provoking, and it's one that's overlooked quite a bit. In the scene, Jesus kind of reminds them, and I say sort of because it's implied, it's direct, but in my opinion, this is one of the very first times that they all begin to understand that Jesus is about to die. I mean, they probably figured he was going to take heat. And in this church, we have a number of kind of rebels. And they're always ready to proverbially burn the mother down. They're always standing against the establishment. I like that commercial that's on TV about a guy who's finally rebelling so much against the system. He's in a tie. He says, "We're going to break the status quo. We're going to stick it to the man." And his young assistant says, "Well, aren't you the man?" And he says, "Well, yes, I am." And he says, "So in fact, you're going to be sticking it to yourself." And that's you get people like that. They're kind of on the rebellious path, and that's good. But these guys finally understand that Jesus is about to... They figured that Jesus was causing so much trouble that maybe someone was going to get him. You know, they were living a little bit like rebels. They figured people would do something about it at some point in time. But now they finally understand that Jesus is going to play into their hands. And the awareness comes that this is about to take place. And so in John chapter 15, they start to panic. Or John 13, a little bit towards verse 15, they start to panic a little bit. Like, what are you talking about? I mean, you're going to be with us forever, right? I mean, you're going to stick around and we're going to have the same thing we're having now. Friends and fellowship, right? And Jesus begins to tell them the story about how he's going to leave. And then in verse 15, he tells them, he begins to establish the relationship with the Spirit. He begins to say, "Listen, if I go, it's going to be better for you because I'm going to send the Spirit." And they begin to understand firsthand what the giving of the Spirit would come to represent. He speaks a little bit about the indwelling of the Father and the Son. He talks about knowledge. And knowledge, as we talked about last week, not like the tree of knowledge that gives us facts, but the tree of life and what it means to be one who bears the life of God. And how bearing the life of God makes a difference in the world that we live in. And Jesus is now promising them that they would have this, the life of God beginning to emanate from their very being. And they begin to understand the relationship between the Spirit and this indwelling. And then it goes on just a bit further. That's in John chapter 14. But in John chapter 13, Jesus also begins to identify something very interesting. Not only is he with his intimate friends, but he also begins to identify his betrayer. He begins to talk to them about who it is that will betray Jesus. And I want you to see that betraying Jesus is not just a metaphor. It's not just a spiritual event. Judas's betrayal is one that's personal and it's tangible. It's an action that happens to Jesus as the result of Judas' act of betrayal. Best intentions in the world, possibly. I'm giving Judas credit for that. But still, it means that Jesus will be wounded and that he will lose on that end of the deal. And then he goes into verse 31, which is really kind of where it starts to change for me. And he begins to, again, remind them about what's going to happen with him. And then in verse 34, he says something very interesting. He says, "A new commandment I give to you, that you should love one another as I have loved you, so that also you would love one another. And by this, all will know that you are my disciples." And then he reminds them again, "if you love one another." Now, this doesn't sound like such a revolutionary concept. Because a new commandment, well, weren't we always supposed to get along with one another? Yes. And weren't we always supposed to keep the interests of others that we're in close relationship with before ours? Yes. And yet Jesus is about to receive the results of one who would betray him. And he would begin to feel tangibly the actions of betrayal. And Jesus is reminding him that if there's an action of betrayal, an action that it's anti-Christ, then there's also an action that is like Christ. It's the loving of one another, the serving of one another. And so I think it's important if we go to 1 Corinthians chapter 13. Jesus is saying that you love one another. It's really not, how is it a new commandment to love one another? Well, I think it's a new commandment, not that you wouldn't, your natural tendencies wouldn't tell you how to love someone, but it's a new commandment in the way that Jesus says that this love is to be manifested. Because it's going to be different than what most people think. 1 Corinthians chapter 13, Paul understands this. Paul is rabbinically trained. Paul is now a follower of Jesus. He is studying so he can make connections between the way that Jesus lived and trying to find interface with Torah, which is how Paul is attempting to live. And I think it's good to see that Paul makes connection with Jesus when it comes to love. And I remember this being taught to me in a very interesting way. Pastor Skip was a guy that taught us that we should look at this passage, and wherever you see the word love is, you should say something like, John loves and like Jesus. You should frame it in that. But for today, I'm not going to do that. I want to read it just plainly, and then we're going to go through and try to find the connection between this new commandment of love. So Paul starts out by saying, though I speak with the tongues of men and angels, and I have not love, I have become a sounding brass or a clanging cymbal. Though I have the gift of prophecy, and I understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have faith so that I could remove mountains, but I have love, I'm nothing. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned, but I have not love, it profits me nothing. Because love suffers long, and it is kind. Love does not envy, and love does not parade itself. Love is not puffed up. Love does not behave rudely, nor does it seek its own. Love is not provoked. It thinks no evil. And that's one of those verses that you should put a underline under. Because it's, again, it's one of those phrases that we can find echoed throughout the Testament. It does not rejoice in iniquity, but it rejoices in truth. It bears all things, believes all things, and it hopes all things, and it endures all things. Love never fails. And I'm going to end at that particular note. You see, Paul is seeing love not as an object. He's not seeing love as even a feeling or an emotion. And the world is a very harsh place. And there are images of God that are in the world are one of a God who is wrathful and angry. A God who will exact your sins from you by way of punishment. That even so much so that as Christians, we still have a bit of that fear left in our conscience. There's a stain in our psyche. There is something about the way we perceive God. We see God similar ways that the world sees God. We see God as angry, as unforgiving, as one who will exact justice. And we are always trying to live on that side of God. And I think that what has happened is that there has been an over-magnification about God as the one who will judge. He will, but the wrathful portrait that we paint is really not the image that God sends of Himself. In John chapter 13, we have to recognize that if God is love, then God is all of these things as well. And if we look at what happened in John chapter 13, we can see that He says, by doing this love, by doing the kind of love that God does, people will know that you're my disciples, because they can see it in the actions that this must be what God is like. God is compassionate and God is kind. And though God is one who exacts judgment and justice, he does so for the sake of working righteousness and never to the degree that he would unduly torture us and exact wrath just for the purpose of being good. And most of us live in that tension that if we do something wrong, God is definitely out to get us. And if not most of you, at least I know George does. So there's this tension that we have of just trying to keep on God's good side because we don't want to wake up on God's bad side. And whenever something bad happens to us, our mind immediately goes back to what we've done wrong that makes us deserve whatever's happening to us. And I've seen people do that on big issues, and I've seen people do that on small issues. I've seen people do that because they get a flat tire or because their electric bill is late. Their first reaction is, what have I done wrong and what must I fix? I remember as an early Christian, I had to travel. I used to just race to the church just to get my tithe check in because I was so committed to that idea of first fruits that, I mean, you know, my pastor loved it because, man, when I got paid on Thursday, that check was in. Hallelujah. We love that guy. Give him an award. But I was doing so out of the wrong spirit of motivation. I was doing it because I didn't want to exact God's justice. You know, I didn't want bad things to happen, so I was moving towards the idea of first fruits. And again, it's maybe a bit over-conceptualized, but that the idea, the motivation about why we're doing what we're doing is very important when it comes to God and how we are portraying God. In one of the difficulties in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, it stems over the whole interpretation of the word all, where it talks about bears all things. It's a poetic picture, but it's a bit subjective. Because does it mean all things as in everything? Or does it mean all things in the sense of a time, like always? You know, we should be doing this perpetually. And in order to fully understand what this means, it's as though that sentence needs to have some kind of a noun, an object, you know, bearing what? All what? All things. So it seems like there should be something else added to it, and there's not. And so you wonder what Paul is thinking or what Jesus was thinking. If Jesus said, this is the most important thing that you can do, love, then you would think that there would be some kind of specific instructions that goes with it, but we find that kind of lacking in the text. So I'm going to call upon Jesus' belief, his self-awareness in the world, and I'm going to call upon Paul's perspective of what love might be, and draw upon a Hebrew concept that's called hesed, which has to do with blessing on one end, but on the other end it speaks of the loving kindness and the mercy of God. It's one of the most pronounced concepts in the Old Testament, the idea of hesed. Hesed is interesting because it's never toward things, objects. You can't hesed a chair or an altar. You would almost always have the concept of hesed as an outflow towards someone. It's always personal. Secondly, it always has to do with the intimate personal relationships that can see hesed working, which means that there's something about knowing each other that the sense of blessing can kind of flow, but there's a lot of times when you do it in the context of not knowing someone, they don't really get the point and they're a bit suspicious, you know? So when I'm doing loving acts towards somebody that I'm in familiar relationship with, they understand it and get it a bit more than people that we don't have relationship with. They actually think, what's going on? So like as an example, someone I know just recently got a gift of $1,000 and it screwed them up. They did not know what to do with the $1,000 because they kept thinking there was a string attached. And I didn't think that because I'm Christian. That kind of thing happens all the time. So there's a sense of blessing that goes with that, but they had a hard time wrapping their mind about why this is coming, and it's because they've been brought up, even in their faith, in a world that sees duty and obedience and merit as being the only reason, the only cause that someone can have, you know, can receive a gift like that. And what seemed to be moving to the person was when I said, well, maybe it's just your time. And maybe this is the way that God is loving you right now. And that by receiving that gift, you're actually receiving the life of God. So don't try to figure out where it came from. Follow the lead, follow the string, and I'm sure you're going to find it at the throne of your Father, because from whom all good things flow. And that's the idea of Hesed, that it somehow is more meaningful to people that we're in intimate relationship with. And what happens outside of that, it can be a bit confusing, but nevertheless, it's still an attribute of God who is loving. So Hesed is also a continuing behavior. When one is called to participate in that kind of covenant, they're called to do it consistently. And they're called to do it over the long haul of something. People fall in and out of love so easily today. And a primary reason is because they see love as a feeling, something that happens to them, not something that is flowing through them, but they're either in it or they're out of it. And it's really antithetical to how love was supposed to move. It was supposed to be a living, dynamic relationship that was flowing, ebbing and flowing with life. And it had to do with the focus of working good. Remember I told you that God is one who, there may be judgment associated, but almost always for the purpose of working the better good. God is committed to working the betterment of one person. So it's because that people that are in this kind of intimate relationship should have the goal of the well-being of others in their mind. That we should be serving another person should be because I want them to be better off because I'm serving them. So the idea that each person should be the recipient of well-being is important. That's the connection between that and Micah chapter 6 verse 8, where Micah instructs us that God would have us do justly and to walk humbly. And I think that the idea, again, is who we are in the world and what we are embodying, but not just as vain, shallow, static things that, you know, love is cheap on that end, but something that's meaningful, something that's bringing connection, something that's bringing life. Now, interesting enough, the word Hesed is not necessarily seen the same way through every Old Testament story. In most places, it kind of has to do with what one would do because we're in an intimate relationship with each other. Of course, I would buy gifts for my wife because I love her. And I would buy gifts for my children because I love them. I would do for those that are within my care because that's my primary responsibility. But when Jesus said in John chapter 13 that a new commandment I give unto you, he's saying the same thing that Hosea said, and he's the only prophet that says it, but the idea takes on a completely different turn than just taking care of those that you would take care of because you're in relationship with them. It takes on an entirely new nuance. I mean, Jesus is saying several times that he asks questions of them. Who is your neighbor? Because it's not just who you think you should be charged in care over. That's your trip over that. I got to fix my thought there. But we oftentimes think about just taking care of those that are around us, and we don't think much about caring for people that we don't really know all that much. But Jesus is reorienting the idea to say, what I'm saying is loving one another and loving everyone else, loving the world like I love the world. And John gets that point, and which is why he includes it in John chapter 1. You see, love to Hosea was a very different concept as well. It where every other instance, Hesed was something that Israel should do for God, in Hosea, the word was almost nonsensical and jarring to the people and community of faith at that time. It seemed illogical of speaking of Hesed in this way because they couldn't see how it would bring them any good. But the new dimension of love or Hesed to Hosea was speaking about this interrelation that God had with Israel. He wanted Israel to be faithful to him so that that would ultimately bleed into the world, so that they would lead the other nations in worship of the true God of Israel. So it's the idea of Israel carrying through on the promise, the covenant, both in their worship of God, and somehow it took on a sociological idea that it kind of represented the whole of the law. If they loved others, they somehow fulfilled the whole of the law. And Hosea is about the only one who actually says it that way. So this is what God desires to make Israel. He's asking Israel to, through their own volition, to be the thing I have made you to be. And so although God has been powerful to Israel, the purpose of them being resourced and becoming into this place of power was not so they could be self-serving, not so they could spend it on themselves, not so they could stare at injustice in the face and do nothing as long as they were saved at home. I still wonder how we're going to answer for abject poverty in the world and how we're going to answer for the misfortune of others. I don't know exactly what type of judgment that will exact, but I think that I won't be judged on the fact that I didn't do something if I really didn't know about it, but I think I would be held accountable for the things that occurred under my nose and I did nothing about them because I was apathetic or I was self-serving or I wasn't open. You know, I walked recently with a person who greeted a homeless person, and I usually try to keep a bit. I don't keep much, but I'll keep money in my pocket. And sometimes it's a lot, sometimes it's a little, but I keep it there for the sole purpose if someone asks, I'm going to give it to them. Now, the objection to that is that I would be perpetuating what's going on in that person's life. Like, you're giving money to a guy who's just going to buy liquor, or you're giving money to a guy that's just going to go buy drugs. You're giving money to a person who might just be going to prostitution. And I think all that might be true, but I don't know that to be true. And the reason that I keep it around to do it is because I think one day I'm going to have to answer for my acts of conscience, the times that I had it and I didn't share because I was trying to lead them in some moral or ethical growth. As the song says, they just need to get a job. And they need to be productive, and I'm perpetuating that. Well, maybe, maybe not. The point is was I moved with compassion like Jesus would move with compassion? What is the pathos of Jesus' heart? Was he not moved to the action, love moving as a verb, into the lives of people? And the answer has got to be yes. So it's an attitude and an action that somehow was within our control to give to God. I think that's the tricky part. God is not asking from us something that he has already set up, something that he has already destined to take place. There has to be a willing submission, a dying to self involved, because one of the primary characteristics of love is sacrifice and self-serving. So I believe that Israel had a freedom to choose to respond or to not respond. And I think the book of Hosea, if you do give it a quick read at some point in time, it's not that big of a book. The images of marriage and parent and child for the purpose of covenant relationship, they talk to us in the same kind of intimate terms that Jesus is using in John chapter 13. And it expresses how God is frustrated at the failure of people to live out their part of the relationship by being God's representatives in the world. And it's not just doing what is needed. This is where I think it takes a turn and it connects with the topic. It has to do with the saving of relationship. It has to do with you being a repairer of the world. That in your act of giving and in your act of reaching out, you are making a deliberate attempt at saving the relationship, which is really where I want to be. Now, whether it's a marriage, or whether it's a parent-to-child situation, or whether it's a friend relationship, many relationships break down and end because people just choose to do nothing about it. Marriages and relationships that tend to die are those that where people stand by and watch the lifeblood flow out of it and do nothing to give it CPR. It's through their obstinance and their withdrawal that the life and the love just slowly dies. And I see this even in the portrayal of Jesus, who says, "Hey, I just washed your feet. I just gave you a promise of the Spirit to come. I have loved even in spite of my personal betrayal. I have loved you in this way, and I'm so charging you to love others, because your action is one in the vision of Hesed that can save relationship. And not just relationship with you and others that get established, but the very vital, life-giving relationship that comes from God alone. And so we can see that that's where we become an extension. Our life that we are transmitting comes through the conduit of love, and it's for the sole purpose of saving the relationships, and our acting in that way really is one of the first steps of repairing the world. So when he was speaking of the righteousness and justice and mercy and faithfulness of God, it's because God saw their act of saving as somehow bringing peace to the whole of creation. Have you ever noticed that whenever community is genuine and people are actually living in vital relationship with one another, that there is somehow a more peace in the world because of that? And usually when there's dissension, it oftentimes breeds fear and division. Now, that may not make a lot of sense to most of you. I've had two opportunities in my life, one in the 1960s and then one at the tail end of the Rodney King trial, where I was an unwilling participant in the riots of Los Angeles. One time I was a boy, and I remember vividly being in the back seat of my stepfather's car when he screamed at us to get down. And we drove on a street where there was a mass of angry people heading down the street with torches in their hand, getting ready to burn a store. And my stepfather just, you know, left town. And I remember much later in life, after the tail end of the Rodney King trials, that I really didn't think it was going to go that far. I mean, LA's always been somewhat of a angry place, but I really didn't think it was going to go as far as it did. So much so that I went to work that day. And I was completely oblivious to anything even occurring. And then I was called by our pastor, said, "Hey, oh my God, how are you? Are you okay? Are you going to get out of there?" And that was the first time I began to realize that something grave was taking place right outside my front door. By the time I got to my car, which was less than 20 minutes later, a shooting had already taken place at the factory, and the whole city was in chaos. And it was angry. The whole city was angry. I mean, there were people storming the Hawthorne Mall. And we were, you know, stuck at a stoplight. On one side were the National Guard, and the other side were these shoppers with their brick credit cards getting ready to go loot a Macy's. There was a guy running down a street with a giant screen TV in a wheelbarrow. There were vans. At that time, Astro vans were pretty popular, you know, mighty machines that they are. And they were actually right in front of us. I saw something a little bit awry with the back door. And we were a bit behind him. We were probably maybe 100 feet. And I was with a guy. We were in a red 240 SX that said, "I love Simi Valley" on the bumper sticker. And I remember driving down the road, and I saw this car. And I'm like, "Something's wrong. You need to stop." And boom, the doors open up, and out come these guys going, "Come on." It was a big gang. They were waiting for the two white guys in the red 240 SX. Now, we made it out of there, and I was grateful to hit the freeway. I remember how sobering it was to look back over my shoulder and watch the city on fire. So see, there was division that was there. Division that didn't need to happen. Division that was done in the name of justice. And yet people revolted against that because it didn't seem to them like it was a loving act. And then at the point when I could have responded, to be honest with you, I was afraid. I wasn't thinking about witnessing to anybody at that time. I just wanted to get out of Dodge. But I'll tell you that the reciprocal effect, even though none of you are giving credit to this or credence to this, is when we don't love, we give place to division and death. When we do nothing about it and we sit by apathetically and let relationships die and let people just live on their own and do nothing, being the kind of life givers that we are, we've not only failed to repair the world, but we've actually contributed to its damage. We've also made the damage worse by doing nothing at all. And so the idea here is, like, on something, let's say forgiveness, which is something that I have been wrestling with for a number of years, because I have someone that I am angry at, and I've been angry at them for a long time, and I don't want to forgive them because I don't think that they deserve it. I think what they did was hurtful, mean-spirited, and unjust. But yet, at the end of the day, I am left alone with my feelings of that person and God. And I have to reconcile in my heart about how long will I do nothing about the death that's right before me and not at least make the slightest attempt at bringing life back into something that was dead. And I am not speaking to you in something I have not worked through myself. It's the whole idea of forgiveness. Forgiveness on one end, yes, it sets you free. But do you realize that without forgiveness and forbearance, relationship is impossible? That without me being forgiving towards my wife and towards my children, if I don't let bygones be bygones, I have not simply just have to learn to live with it and get tougher skin. I am actively destroying the relationship because I am refusing to let the life of God happen between us. Do you understand? So forgiveness is the foundation of what it means to be in relationship with each other. And it's a hard concept, but it is love again moving in action. So the last thing that I would bring to you back again is just some just ideas about love as we've seen it. Relationship would make a peaceable world. It's forgiveness that makes these things possible, and it's this vision that Paul has in mind, and it's the same vision that Jesus has in mind when each one of them give us those words. So first of all, we got to realize that love, obviously, in Corinthians is not a static term. It's not a noun. It's a verb. It's action. Love must take action. It must be self-sacrificing. It must embody God's ways in the world. It must take back what has been given over to death, abandoned, forsaken. It must move to bring the life of God into barren places. That's the purpose of loving, like Paul says to love. I've always been attracted to the bearing all, believing all, hoping all, and enduring all. And I've always thought of bearing, because of my limited construction background, as something that bears a lot of weight, something that makes the building stronger because it exists. Because bearing speaks to me of not just tolerating, which is a big word today. We use it when it comes to things we don't like abortion clinics and homosexuals. We always say, well, we're tolerant. Well, I don't think tolerance is enough, because I think tolerance speaks of indifference, and it limits love from really happening. But I think when it talks about bearing, it's the stuff that must be put up with. It's the stuff that must be faced. It's the stuff that must be worked at. The things that must be suffered for in order for it to have context. The believing, you've heard me talk about this before. I put believing in as a synonymous term to trust. I don't think you can believe in someone if you don't trust them. And trust is what gives life to faith at all. Believing isn't just accepting. It has to do with a sacrificing an investment in someone because you trust them. And maybe you're at the point where you can't trust someone, but you can at least trust God. But that's what it means to believe all things. It doesn't just mean, well, I'll take you at your word, or I'll just accept what you have to say. It's actually the investment part of it, the sacrifices that we make, because we know that to be true, even if it's not happening yet. Because that's why it's connected to hoping. Because hoping reaches out from where we are right now into what may be. And if we don't have belief and we're not willing to invest, then whatever might be will not become realized because we have failed to take action on it. Do you understand what I'm saying in that? So if love's hoping all things, it's reaching from the crap you're experiencing right now into something that's in the future that has not occurred yet, and it won't happen without your investment. Do you understand what I'm saying in that? Reality will not take place to bring about that manifestation of God unless you're willing to reach from your present into what might be. So it reaches out from all things present to all things future. Enduring is a weird word too. Because I think it's sort of like bearing, like the things that you got to put up with, but it's something more. I think it talks about determination. I've never been able to find this passage. I know I read it, so I might have still been doing a lot of weed at that time. But I remember reading in the passage of Scripture, the Bible said to arm yourself with determination. And again, I don't know where I got it. I'm convinced I got it in the Bible, and I've yet to find a translation that says it. So you might have to just say I made it up, or you're going to believe in me, okay? But somewhere I got the idea that you should be armed with determination. Because, and what, why I think that's important is because it's easy to be wishy-washy about love. It's easy to be sort of in when it comes to love. It's easy to kind of say, well, I'm here while I'm here. And while I'm getting what I'm going to get. But real love isn't like that. That's not how God is. God is the kind of person, which I make fun of myself, but I say this, that I'm too stupid to quit. And I actually think that that's kind of an attribute of God. He is so committed to us. So committed to us that Paul has spent much of his writings in Romans, Corinthians, and Ephesians to just remind us that God will not quit on us. That this love is so powerful that neither height nor depth, nor principality or powers, nor things created or things in other realms will be able to separate us from the love of God. Not just because love itself is like Kevlar or steel, but because God is alive and He is so vital and the life of God is so strong. He is without exhaustion. And no matter how hard you run away from God, you cannot outrun the Holy Spirit. And He is so committed to you that He will never let you go. No matter what you're facing, no matter what you're going through, you need to get the eye of God, not just God as a lion, and not just God as a tree, but maybe God like an octopus. The love is just sticking to us everywhere we turn. It's smothering us in a whole way. It's not going to let us go. It encompasses everything around us. And at times it's embraced, and other times, like David, out of exasperation, he says, where am I going to go to escape you? I can't go to the heights of heavens or the pit of hell, because wherever I turn, you're there. Even when I want to be left alone in my misery, even when I want to have my own pity party, God's presence is overtaking David. That's the chesed of God. The loving kindness of God is there when we deserve it. He is there applauding us when we have our merits, as Hebrews says. But He's also there bearing our burdens when we fail. And the love of God is so tenacious that even when we feel like we're weak and we can't go one more step, the love of God is our strength. And His grip on us is so strong. So strong. His embrace of us is so powerful that the shaking and the fighting, and I am one that understands that when physical intimacy is shown, but it so secures us that after a period of time we just give up and we let go. And the peace of God then just comes. It just comes. And we find ourselves secure in the haven or the stronghold of God. It's a powerful concept, friends. This love. It's not just words for greeting cards. It's not just poetic. It's powerful. And it's the good thing about this love of God is that it's not just what's seen in Him. Of course God is like that. No. when Jesus says, love one another like I have loved you, he wasn't modeling. He was saying, you can. No, I can't. That person's difficult. Yes, you can. I can't take it. Yes, you can. Because the life of God has become activated. It's become a force. It's something that emanates from you. And I know it's true because there's been times that I have been wanting to quit. But yet the Spirit of God comes to me in the night. Very similar to what happened to me last night. Where the Spirit of God says, I love you. And you're like, what? And it's not that I wasn't eager to hear it. It's because I wasn't feeling all that good about where I am. But yet the love of God is such that even when I am a jackass in the flesh, I am a prince in the spirit because of the love of God. Do you understand where I'm at today? So love is the banner, the Bible says. He is Jehovah Nissi, our banner. And his banner over us is love, not false expectancy, not wrath, but compassion, pathos, fire, active work in restoring you, and in so doing, empowering you to restore the world. And I think I'll read from... I had these points. Love is deliberate. It's despite our disappointment. It's without object. And it's not an object itself, but it's a state of being before the presence of our God.